arabesques and has written poetry and children's stories in both Hebrew and Arabic. He is a translator of works by Samuel Beckett, Athol Fugard, the South African writer, and Emil Habibi. He teaches in the Department of Near Eastern Studies at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. He's also a member of the board of the International Writers Center. He's a native of Israel. His first time reading here in St. Louis, at least here at Duff, so make him feel at home and lend him your ears. Anton Chamas.
Problem. I was given like 28 minutes tops, and no matter what I did this afternoon, every time I read and rehearsed, it came out like 32 minutes. So what I'll do is I start reading, and then when my little watch shows 28 minutes, I just stop. I thought first that I would be reading maybe a short passage or two passages from a nonfiction piece which I published a couple of months ago called America, America. This is the way the United States are referred to in the Middle East, with a Kafkaesque K, America. And it's subtitled Palestinian Abroad in the Land of the Free. So maybe I'll just start off with that, and then as I go along, I'll decide whether it's worth reading further or just switch to arabesques. We will see. It's 8:08 now. So I'll start off with the opening passage from an essay called America, America. Some years ago in San Francisco, I heard the following tale from a young American-educated Palestinian engineer. We had found a rustic, trendy place and managed to find a quiet table over lukewarm beers rather than small cups of lukewarm cardamom coffee. We talked about his family, which had wandered adrift in the Arab world for some time before finding its moorings on the West Coast, and in particular of a relative of his living to the south of San Francisco, whom we were planning to visit the following day. We never did make that visit, that's a story too, but the story about this man has fluttered inside my head ever since. We will call him Abu Khalil. Imagine him as a 40-something Palestinian, he is now past 60, I would imagine, whose West Bank homeland was, once again in his lifetime, caving in on him in June 1967 after what the Arabs call the defeat of Haziran 5th, and the Israelis and Americans call the Six-Day War. Where was he to spend the occupation years of his life? Where could he get as far away from the Israeli benign presence as his captive mind could go? The choices were essentially two. He could cross the Allenby Bridge to His Majesty's Jordan, or he could take an unhijackable flight west from Ben Gurion Airport. He chose the latter, a plane that would carry him to the faraway USA. To those members of his large family, Arabs always seem to have large families, who had discovered the New World centuries after Columbus. They had discovered the New World, as they would tell him later, in a sort of belated westbound revenge for for the eastbound expulsion of their great ancestors from Andalusia, Spain, the same year that Columbus's Spanish ships arrived on the shores of his imaginary India. To continue our tale, Abu Khalil lands in San Francisco one warm September afternoon, clad in a heavy black coat that does not astonish his waiting relatives a bit, since they are familiar with the man's eccentricities. But what about the security guys at Ben Gurion Airport? Didn't the out-of-season coat merit suspicion and a frisking? Apparently not. Abu Khalil is, as far as I can tell, the only Palestinian to have seeped out through the thick security screenings at Ben Gurion Airport unsearched. How else to account for the fact that he had managed to carry on board with him a veritable little Palestine, flora, fauna, and all? His bags were heavy with small plants and seeds that went undetected by Israeli security. As for U.S. Customs Form 6059B, which inbound foreigners are graciously asked to fill out before they land, it prohibits passengers from importing, quote, fruits, vegetables, plants, plant products, soil, meats, meat products, birds, snails, and other live animals and animal products, end of quote. Our passenger, to the best of the storyteller's authorial knowledge and mine, could not read English, and no American officer, lawful or otherwise, bothered to verify his declarations, albeit not made, through questioning, much less through physical search, these being two procedures that Palestinians are much accustomed to in their comings and goings in the Middle East. So that's how Abu Khalil managed to bring to California some representative plants of Palestine, many still rooted in their original fecund soil. It seems, however, that he took pride mainly, and think of it as a feather in his kufiyah, in his having managed to smuggle out of the West Bank through Israel and into the United States seven representative birds of his homeland: the Duri, Hassoun, Sununu, Shahrur, Bulbul, Summan, and the Hudhud, small talk companion to King Solomon himself. They all surrounded him now in California, re-chirping Palestine away in his ears from inside their unlocked American cages. They will not leave their open cages, Abu Khalil would say, or so the story went, till I leave mine. Abu Khalil's was a cage of his own making. He has not left it to this very day, but I was mainly interested in the birds, in their mute, wondrous migration. In the years that followed, I asked the storyteller, did they forget their mother chirp, meaning the birds? Did they eventually adopt the mellow sounds of California? And how, I asked, did he manage to smuggle in these birds in the first place? Well, said my friend, he had a coat of many pockets, you see. Now, many Middle Eastern Abu Khalils have immigrated to the USA over the years, driven out of their respective homelands by wars, greedy foreigners, and pangs of poverty. At the turn of the century, with the Ottomans, who had been ruling the Middle East since 1517, were practicing some refined forms of their famine policy. Arabs left their homes and families and sailed to the Americas. Brazil and the Argentina had their charm. Michigan, too. Today, Michigan is home to the largest Arab-American community in North America. If you were to take a stroll through the streets of Dearborn, a south by southwest suburb of Detroit, the signs and names might remind you of some ancient legend. Bereft of names and deeds, these Arabs came to Michigan to make names for themselves as a 20th century self-mocking variation on the old Mesopotamian tradition of the Shuma Shakano, the preservation of one's name and deeds. That also was the original aim of those who followed Nimrod the hunter in his biblical endeavor to reach heaven and said, quote, "Let us make us a name for ourselves," Genesis 11. An American heaven of sorts, and in this case, an American name. Hoping for a happier ending than the biblical one, they have come from places whose names Mark Twain, the great American nomenclator, traveling with the Innocents Abroad some 124 years ago, found impossible to pronounce. Quote, "One of the great drawbacks to this country," he wrote in September 1867, 124 years ago, from Palestine, quote, "it's distressing names that nobody can get the hang of. You may make a stagger of pronouncing these names, but they will bring any Christian to grief that tries to spell them. I have an idea that if I can only simplify the nomenclature of this country, I will be of the greatest service to Americans who may travel here in the future." Now, of all the lands on earth for dismal scenery, Twain went on, "I think Palestine must be the prince. The hills are barren. They are dull of color. They are unpicturesque in shape. It is the most hopeless, dreary, heartbroken piece of territory out of Arizona." End of quote. Of course, to the Palestinian ear, Twain's observation sounds like a rough draft of the famous Zionist slogan, quote, "a land without a people to a people without a land," end of quote. "I was born in that," quote, "most hopeless, dreary, heartbroken piece of territory out of Arizona in the month of September. Come April, any American innocent abroad could notice the almost idiotic breeding of lilacs out of the Galilean deadland, the mixing of memory and desire. Mr. Twain, I have been to Arizona, and with all due respect, Arizona ain't no Galilee." As a motto for my reading from Arabesques, I'd like to read some lines from a poem written as an exercise for an English class by a fine Norwegian writer and a dear friend. This was in Iowa City 10 years ago. A poem I also used in Arabesques, and is the, to my mind, the lines I'm going to quote from this poem, to my mind, are the best definition of friendship that I have come across so far. The poem is called Variations on a Text by Vallejo, After Donald Justice. And it goes like this. My best friend, she is bright. Her skin is soft. Her eyes even more blue than the sky above the apartment house. She takes her chewing gum out of her mouth, puts it into mine, says, I can have it for 5 minutes. Which reminds me that once I used to think that the best definition of love, not friendship, best definition of love that I had ever come across was love is when two persons share the same toothbrush. And that was a French saying, I was told. Then later, and Mark is sitting there staring at me, later I read somewhere, apparently in one of these, believe it or not, sections in some stupid magazine, that only one out of four French persons owns a toothbrush. So you may as well wonder how many chewing gums are there in Norway. Now, the first passage is a priestly anecdote about Father Simán and his cat, and the year is the feline year of 1926. Father Simán was wrapped up in his soul that particular day because of what his cat had done. For years he had been devoting himself to the composition of a history of the Catholic Church in the Holy Land, for which purpose he had purchased in distant Beirut a special notebook, splendidly bound in leather, as black as the souls of sinners. On its first page he had inscribed in his best calligraphy the title of the book to be written therein, The Cock Doth Crow in the Catholic Church. He had also attached a bookmark, a scarlet ribbon that had been plucked in a moment of weakness from an antique missal that was in the church. On more than one occasion, Father Simán had suffered sleepless nights and pangs of conscience over this deed. Sometimes, to the inquisitive mews of his cat, he would descend from his sleepless bed to the church door, fingering the scarlet ribbon he was about to return to the missal. But then he would be swayed by various reasons why he needed do so, the leading one being the loftiness of the purpose for which it had been borrowed. It was serving, after all, a unique and unparalleled work which would glorify the Catholic Church among all the Arabic-speaking peoples. Also, once he had completed the text and prepared it for publication, he was going to return the ribbon to its rightful place. It sometimes happened that an early rising rooster would crow and disturb his vigil, for he would recall the words of our Lord that he spake unto Peter, saying, quote, the cock shall not crow till you hast denied me thrice, unquote. Then Father Simán would say unto himself in the words of Saint Peter, quote, I will lay down my life for thy sake, but I will not deny thee in any wise, and I will return the ribbon unto its place. But in time, the origin of the ribbon slipped away from his conscience. The sentences of the text had long since taken their final form in his ornate Arabic calligraphy, and even though the work of editing and correcting had long been completed, the ribbon still lay between the pages of the notebook, peeping and spiraling out of it, its fringe caressing the shelf. Directly under this shelf stood a large crock into which the villagers would pour as much of their virgin olive oil as their spirit of generosity moved them to give at the end of the pressing season. Now, on that particular day, Father Simeon had decided to take the tiniest bit of oil to add to the dish he was preparing in his meager kitchen. As he was returning the cover to the crock, he noticed that it hadn't been washed for some time. He took it and went back to the kitchen, where he found his cat sniffing around the simmering pot. Father Simeon, in his wrath, loudly scolded the cat and expelled her from his kitchen. The cat, still salivating, slunk into the other room, and there she sees on the shelf, above the open crock of oil, the glistening tail of a mouse. Instantly, the cat leapt up and pounced upon Father Simeon's notebook and struggled to claw her way between the pages. As she scrabbled and kicked and pulled and scratched, she pushed the notebook straight into the jar. Father Simeon returned with the rinsed cover in his hand and threw his habitual glance over toward the notebook, as if to assure himself of its well-being. And lo, the twice frustrated cat lay there in its stead. With rancorous eyes, he looked into the jar and spied a dark patch in its depths. He rolled up his sleeve and drew out the cock doth crow in the Catholic Church, and discovered that the calligraphy which had adorned the pages of the notebook had returned to its liquid state. Father Simeon laid the dripping notebook on the shelf and tore out the scarlet ribbon in order to return it to the church at once. Now, I will read just the couple of lines from the Hebrew original. This is the beginning of this Father Simeon's tale, just for you to get the hang of it, as Mark Twain would have said. Avinu Michael hit'atfa nafsho alav b'yom ahu, begin ma'alaleha shel hatulato. זה לא שנים שהוא שוקד על כתיבת חיבור על תולדות הכנסייה הקתולית בארץ הקודש, ולשם כך קנה בביירות הרחוקה מחברת מיוחדת, הדורה ומחורכת אור שחור כנפש החוטאים, ועל עמודה הראשון כתב בציפורן באותיות מסולסלות, כי יד הכתיבה התמה הטובה עליו, את כותרתו של הספר העתיד להיכתב עליה לימור, קריאת התרנגולים בכנסיית הקתולים, וגם סימניה חיבר לשורשי הדפים סרט שני שנתלש ברגע של חולשה מסידור תפילה עתיק שהיה בכנסייה. לא אחת נדדה שנתו של אבינו מיכאיל וישרה אותו נפשו על מעשה ידיו, ולכל יללות התימהון של החתולה היה יורד מעל יצוע שמוריו ובא בדלת הכנסייה ואצבעותיו מנהל.